verb phrase. I have been running. Okay, the perfect here involves have plus the past participle. The progressive involves be plus the present participle. In have been running, the perfect comes first. So we get the have first, and then we get the progressive. We get the be. So we start with have, and then we get the be for progressive. Now, have needs a past participle. So the be form becomes the past participle form because it's affected by have been. Then the be needs the present participle. So it makes a present participle out of running. Have been running. That's a lot of information to know to create this phrase that you create all the time. Standard English does not have a way to express habitual aspect through the verb form itself. But African American English, one of the systematic dialects of American English, does have habitual aspect captured through what linguists call habitual be. For example, in African American English, a phrase like, a clause like she be running would be to express a habitual action, like she be running these days. This is something she's doing habitually. Another example, he be joking around all the time, right? So that be there suggests that this is something that happens habitually. When people sometimes who are not speakers of African American English try to create sentences in African American English, they will often get this use of be wrong because they don't realize the grammar behind it, that the be marks habitual aspect. Standard English marks the habitual primarily through adverbials, such as usually or all the time. Habitual be is seen as non-standard variation, as is the past tense drug, the phrase have went, and it go down that way, where you don't have the S on the third person singular. But what I hope I've shown you is that there is a system here. There's a grammatical system at play here. It's different from standard American English, but there's a system. And it's not that there's no variation in standard English. We already saw this with has swelled and has swollen, and let's look at another example. Let's look at the past participles of the verb prove. Many of us, myself included, have both proved and proven available. Are both of those standard for you? They are for me, and I think I don't even notice whether I'm using proved or proven. But it hasn't always been the case that both have been considered standard. Proven was criticized in the past when it came into common use. The verb prove is borrowed from French, and it came in as a regular verb, proved, prove, proved, past participle, proved. But then it developed the past participle proven. Proven seems to originate in the past participle of the Scottish English form preve, on analogy, spelled P-R-E-V-E, on analogy probably with cleave, cloven, weave, woven, prove, proven. When proven was newer, it met with resistance, to say the least. Here's Richard Grant White in his book, Words and Their Uses, Past and Present, published in 1876. He writes of proven. Proven, which is frequently used now by lawyers and journalists, should perhaps be ranked among words that are not words. Proved is the past participle of the verb to prove and should be used by all who wish to speak English. Wow. Who knew that proven wasn't even a word? Brian Garner addresses it in his usage guide as well. He writes, proved has long been the preferred past participle of prove, but proven often ill-advisedly appears. For all of us who are part of the often there, who are using proven, we may not realize that it was ill-advised. Now, the use of proven is accepted in some legal contexts. For example, innocent until proven guilty, and not proven. The Associated Press style book also tells us not to use proven as a past participle, to use proven only as an adjective, as in a proven remedy. But, of course, many of us do use proven as a past participle. And here's an example from an academic journal, the Journal of International Affairs, just to show how easy it is to find these in standard edited prose. Here's the quote. The above-mentioned measures have been implemented half-heartedly and for the most part have proven to be ineffective. Many standard dictionaries list both past participles, proved and proven, as standard. All in all, I find this a useful reminder that views on what is good and bad usage change over time. And proven is now unremarkable for many, if not most of us. There are a few other irregular past participles that are now typically adjectives. For example, shaven and mown, M-O-W-N. Now, I have to say, my students, however, believe that mown is not a word at all. They just look at me like I'm crazy when I say mown. Both shave and mow were strong verbs in Old English, so they were verbs that made past tense through a vowel change, and that means that they made a past participle with the final en. Over time, both shave and mow have developed regular ed past tenses and past participles, shaved and mowed. It's part of that regularization. As a result, we have something like, he has shaved, but he is clean shaven. They have mowed the lawn, and it is a freshly mown lawn. Or maybe it's a freshly mowed lawn if you also believe that mown is not a word. It is tempting to think that the same pattern must hold for the verb sow and its two past participles, sowed, and here I'm talking about sow, S-E-W, its past participle sowed and sown. I have sowed, I have sown, both of which are now seen as standard past participles for the verb sow. But sow, S-E-W, started as a weak verb. It started as what we now consider a regular verb with a past tense with ed and a past participle with ed. So past participle sowed. By Middle English, so had developed the irregular past participle sown, probably through analogy with so, S-O-W, and its past participle sown. As a result, now we have sowed and have sown, and have sown is actually now significantly more common than have sowed. The example of sow is a good reminder that in the verb system, like other places in the language, there can be a pressure to regularize, but new idiosyncrasies are introduced into the system all the time. In this lecture, we've talked about strong and weak verbs and how there has been some movement back and forth over time. In the next lecture, we'll look at another way to categorize verbs. This time we'll categorize them based on how they function in a sentence, specifically whether or not the verb can take an object or not take an object, and if it can take an object, how many objects can it take?
Lecture 11, Object Lessons.
I started the previous lecture on verbs with a joke, or at least the start of a joke. And for some inexplicable reason, I got inspired to start this lecture on verbs with a joke as well. Let's start with a knock-knock joke that I made up just for this occasion. Knock-knock. Who's there? It's me. No, it's I. No, it's not you, it's me. No, it's not me, it's I. Are you having an identity crisis? Okay, so it's a bad knock-knock joke, but the correction it captures is a familiar one. We are just trying to self-identify that we're the ones on the phone or at the door, and we face this grammatical conundrum. Do we say, it is me or it is I? I grew up being corrected on this, being told that I should say, it is I. And the traditional rule for this construction sets out that "It is I" is the correct form. The basis for this correction is that the verb to be is a linking verb. And as a linking verb, it equates, so to speak, the subject with the predicate noun phrase or the predicate adjective phrase that comes after to be. If we say something like, "Anne is a grammar geek," we are equating Anne and grammar geek. If we say, "Anne's grammar jokes are weak," we are equating Anne's grammar jokes with the adjective weak. So semantically, the linking verb equates the subject noun phrase and the noun phrase or adjective phrase that's in the predicate. But what happens grammatically? The subject of the sentence is in the nominative case, which means that if it's a pronoun, it will be one of these pronouns: I, we, he, she, it, they, you. Does that mean that the predicate noun, the noun after the verb to be, also needs to be in the nominative case? Does it need to match the subject? Some prescription on this question says yes. And if you say yes, then it needs to be, "It is I," or "It is she speaking." But it can sound odd to most of us to say something like, "It is we. It is we at the door," instead of, "It's us." And here's a pretty awkward sentence. "I asked who called yesterday, and it was he." Our gut may want to say, "It was him," or "It's me." And I can put your mind at ease here. Many usage guides now say that both "it is me" and "it is I" are acceptable. It is, rather than an issue of grammaticality, often an issue of formality. Are you still not feeling completely comfortable with "it's me"? Let me just point out that other languages show that the predicate noun, the noun coming after to be, does not need to be in the nominative case. For example, in French, you would say, "C'est moi," which is the equivalent of, "It is me." And Joseph Priestley brought this up in the 1700s in his grammar as part of his defense, and this is in the 1700s, of the phrase, "It's me." Both constructions, "it's me" and "it's I," have been in educated use for several centuries. We'll spend this lecture thinking about how we categorize verbs based on how they function in the sentence. Specifically, do they take an object, or two, or none, like a linking verb? There are a surprising number of usage issues linked to this categorization of verbs, including the "it is me, it is I" conundrum. We'll start with linking verbs, and then we'll talk about the transitive-intransitive distinction with verbs, including some usage questions such as whether the verb "grow" can function transitively. For example, can you grow a business? Back to linking verbs. The verb to be is by far and away the most common linking verb, probably because it is the most common verb in the English language. And there is another well-known usage issue around the linking verb be. And the question is, are you good or are you well? It is such a simple question. How are you? And it's simple if we answer with just one word. Fine, okay, good, exhausted, fantastic, ducky. I'm trying to bring ducky back as a response to how are you. We'll see if I can succeed. In any case, if we just say one word, we're fine. But if we say, "I am blank," we are told that things get more complicated. I learned growing up that I should say, "I am well." I should not say, "I am good." I was told, "It's not about your moral goodness, Anne. It's not about whether you are a good person. It is about whether you are well." But is it? When I say, "I am well," I am, at least in my own head, referring to my health, my state of wellness. But what if I want to answer the question more generally about my overall state of being? If I want to say that I'm in a good place, that my life is generally free of troubles, Why can't I say, I'm good, in the same way that I could say, I feel good, or the food is good? You can. This prescription about I'm well instead of I'm good does not hold up under scrutiny. And let me explain why. Given that to be is a linking verb, in the clause I am blank, we should expect an adjective there. Terrible, tired. The word well is both an adjective and an adverb. And I think this is where things get confused. Well is the adverb form of good. So if you were to say, I am a good cook, there you have good as an adjective, and you wanted to put an adverb in, you would say, I cook well, at least in standard varieties of English. But well is also an adjective in reference to health. I am well, I am feeling well. Good is generally an adjective. For example, the food is good, the good food. But in some non-standard varieties of English, it is also an adverb, so that you could say something like, he runs good, he cooks good. This is a fairly stigmatized construction. My guess is that concerns about good as an adverb in things like he runs good have bled over to encourage a sense that there's something wrong with I am good. But in that sentence, I am good, good is serving as an adjective. It is just like saying, I feel good. So, in fact, we can say either, depending on what we mean. And I would add that I do think there is a formality distinction. I will sometimes hear people, when they're bumping it up a little bit, say, I am well. Some other common linking verbs in addition to be are to become, to appear, to seem, to feel. And the verb feel raises another usage question. When something unfortunate happens and you are feeling sympathy for someone else, are you feeling bad for that person or are you feeling badly for that person? Here's where I think the confusion stems from in this case. Feel can function in different ways. It can be a transitive verb. In other words, it can take an object. I felt the cold tile under my feet. Feel can also be an intransitive verb. Imagine that I had lost feeling in my hand, and now I have gotten the feeling back in my hand, and I say, I can feel, because I'm so excited. And then feel can be a linking verb in a sentence like, I feel great, or I feel ducky. The difference then between bad and badly is the difference between an adjective and an adverb. So we would use the adjective bad after any other linking verb. For example, that seems bad. And we would use the adverb badly after an intransitive verb. For example, I failed badly. And I think that is on my mind because clearly I'm still worried about that bad knock-knock joke I started this lecture with. At least in theory, one could feel bad or feel badly depending on what you mean. Although I have to say the latter seems like it wouldn't come up too much. And let me explain. There is technically a meaning difference between I feel badly and I feel bad. If you feel badly, the idea is, or at least so the story goes, that you have a bad sense of feel. In other words, you're trying to feel things, but you're having trouble feeling them, and you feel badly. If you feel bad, then you have a bad feeling. So technically, you feel bad for someone else's misfortune. Although I think that that can sound, at this point, overly informal, or even wrong to some speakers, to say, I feel bad that that happened to you. People think, ugh, I'm not sure that's right. What seems to be happening here is that confusion has led to anxiety about what is correct, and that has led to some hypercorrection, in this case toward badly. And in the end, we may need to rethink what is technically correct. In other words, feel badly to mean feel bad may become standard. With all other verbs in English, sometimes referred to as action verbs, we talk about their relationship to objects. Can they take an object or not? And if they can take an object, do they take one object or two? It's actually a mistake to think of these as categories of verbs. I think it's more accurate to think about it as how a verb behaves in a sentence, because many verbs can appear both with and without objects, sometimes with one object, sometimes with two. And you see this in dictionary entries. If you look up a verb, you'll often see a definition for the verb intransitive and the verb transitive, showing that verbs, many verbs can do both. For example, let's take the verb read. It can take no object, one object, or two objects. Here's a sentence with no object. I read. Or, I read every day, because every day there is functioning adverbially. With no object, we call that an intransitive verb. Read can also take one object. I read the newspaper. We would call that a monotransitive verb, taking one mono object. Sometimes you will also just see that referred to as transitive. Then read can take two objects. For example, I read my grandmother the newspaper. There, the verb is ditransitive. It takes two objects. And we'll come back to the issue of which is the direct object there and which is the indirect object. Right now, the key is that intransitive verbs don't have objects, and transitive ones take at least one. Even verbs we typically think of as intransitive can often be created, can be put in a sentence to be made transitive. For example, take the verb walk. We would often say, I walk. I walk around the park, I walk around the house, I walk to school. All of those are intransitive. But we can make it transitive. For example, I walk the dog. And we can even make it ditransitive with two objects. I walked him the bike. Sometimes this question of whether a verb can be transitive or intransitive is controversial. For example, whether grow can be transitive outside of agriculture. Everyone agrees that you're allowed to grow crops. But are you allowed to grow your business? What do you think of this sentence? One of our key strategies is to grow our business by increasing the number of clients. This exact sentence was given to the American Heritage Usage Panel in 1992, and 80% of the usage panel rejected it. It was given to the usage panel again in 2014, and 60% accepted it, which is a pretty striking change. In other words, it looks like grow as a transitive verb in the context of, for example, business is becoming accepted as more standard. Conversely, there have sometimes been transitive verbs, verbs that take an object, that people felt shouldn't become intransitive. For example, Richard Grant White, in his book Words and Their Uses, Past and Present, published in 1876, had this to say about the verb leave. And here I quote, "This verb is very commonly ill-used by being left without an object. Thus, Jones left this morning. I shall leave this evening. Left what? Shall leave what? Not the morning or the evening, but home, town, or country. When this verb is used, the mention of the place referred to is absolutely necessary. To wind up a story with, then he left, is as bad as to say, then he sloped. Worse, for slope is recognized slang." So there's Richard Grant White feeling cranky about using leave as an intransitive verb. Of course, now it seems completely unremarkable to do that. We all left. We all left the building. To end a novel with then he left? I mean, maybe it would be a sad ending to a novel, but there'd be nothing ungrammatical about it. To talk in more detail about transitivity, let's step back and talk briefly about word order in English. At this point in modern English, we have quite rigid word order. Subject and object are determined pretty much purely through word order. The subject comes before the verb, the object comes after the verb. As we've talked about, this was not always the case in English. Old English had a case system where nouns took inflectional endings that marked their grammatical function. Were they the subject, the direct object, the indirect object? When you have those kinds of inflectional endings, you can have more flexible word order. If the direct object comes before the verb, you still know it's the direct object because it's carrying that ending. As we lost those inflectional endings, we developed more rigid word order, so we have subject, verb, object. Now, only the pronouns still carry case, for example, I, subject, me, object, but they still need to obey the rigid word order we have of modern English. So now, in modern English, as many people will say, the dog bites the man is not news, because we know the dog is the subject there, but the man bites the dog is news. Occasionally you'll see subject, verb, object word order get mixed up. For example, in the song The Little Drummer Boy, we get the object fronted, the lyrics, "Come, they told me, a newborn king to see." Obviously, we need to do that for the rhyme, as opposed to saying to see a newborn king. But this kind of word order is rare and can sometimes feel a little bit stilted. Let me show you an example of what I mean by fairly rigid word order in modern English. With ditransitive verbs, the verbs that take two objects, the direct and indirect object always appear in the same order. Now, just to clarify the difference, the indirect object is to whom or for whom the action of the verb was done. The direct object is what or who was the recipient of the action. In modern English, a sentence with two objects will always be subject, verb, indirect object, direct object. Let me give you a couple of examples. I sent her my tennis racket. I sent her, indirect object, the person to whom I sent the racket, my tennis racket being the direct object. Here's another example. My friend made me a birthday cake. So me, the indirect object, because my friend made the cake for me, a birthday cake is the direct object, what my friend made. You can test which is the indirect object in an interesting way now in modern English. The indirect object can always get bumped out to the end of the sentence with the preposition to or for. Let's go back to the sentence, I sent her my tennis racket. We can take the her, bump it out, and add a to. I sent my tennis racket to her. Or the birthday cake. We had, my friend made me a birthday cake. You can take that indirect object me, bump it out. My friend made a birthday cake for me. As a historical side note here, now in most standard varieties of English, we cannot use the word order subject, verb, direct object, indirect object. Something like, I sent my tennis racket her. But that has not always been true in English. In Old English, and remember that Old English had more flexible word order, you could get both verb, indirect object, direct object, for example, send you money, and verb, direct object, indirect object, send money you. The verb, direct object, indirect object, send money you, becomes unusual in Middle English, at least with two nouns. But if you have two pronouns, it continues to be used with things like send it you. And it in fact remains something of a norm to be able to say things like send it you through the Renaissance. Some 18th century grammars of English even recommend these constructions like show it him, show them me. And while standard varieties of English no longer allow this, or at least don't typically allow, verb, direct object, indirect object, other dialects of English still do. I scatter these historical facts throughout as reminders that standard usage changes. And now, what used to be standard, in this case, can feel almost ungrammatical if you're a speaker of a dialect that no longer allows that. To summarize where we are, we've covered linking verbs, and then verbs that function intransitively, monotransitively, and ditransitively. It seems like we should be done, but there is one remaining funny little class of verbs. And sometimes my students will ask, can we just ignore those verbs? But of course, we're not going to ignore those verbs. These verbs are called complex transitive verbs. It can look like they have two objects, but they function differently from ditransitive verbs. Let me give you an example, and then I'll explain how they function differently. Here's the example. We elected Morgan president of the class. We elected Morgan president of the class. Morgan is the object. And then president of the class is being equated with Morgan. You can imagine an equal sign between Morgan and president. We elected Morgan president of the class. Here, president of the class would be called an object complement. And complement here means a phrase that is completing the predicate. So, and sometimes you'll hear this called an object complement or an object predicative. You can also get an adjective with these complex transitive verbs. For example, my brother called me crazy. Again, think about that equal sign. Me equals crazy because my brother called me crazy. A few of the more common verbs that function in this way as complex transitives are elect, call, name, consider, find, prove, keep. Think about the expression, keep it real. Okay, I know I said there was one remaining class of verbs to talk about, and that was the complex transitive verbs. But in fact, even with that additional category, we haven't covered the whole set of verbs. There's another subset of verbs that always appear with a prepositional phrase as their complement. In other words, again, it's that complement as what's completing the predicate. Let's think about the verb depend. The verb depend can be intransitive. For example, it depends. But if we want to specify what it depends on, we have to use on the way I just did there with what it depends on. For example, it depends on the weather. We cannot say it depends the weather. The verb listen works much the same way. We can listen intransitively. We just listen. Then, if we want to specify the object, we have to add to. We listened to music. So technically, these verbs like listen and depend don't take a direct object. They take a prepositional phrase as their complement. And I'm still not finished, but I promise that this is the last subset of verbs. These verbs look like verbs that require prepositional phrases, but they work differently. I'm going to call these phrasal verbs. You'll sometimes hear them called multi-part verbs. They are verbs composed of a main verb and what linguists will call a particle. Now, this particle looks like a preposition, but it's not. And the word particle is, you're going to see it's a little bit of a cop-out here in terms of what we're referring to. A particle is a word that fulfills a grammatical function in the language, but doesn't fall into the traditional lexical categories. Let me give you some examples of phrasal verbs. Call up, ask out, look up, blow up, break out, cheer up, come down with. There you can see a phrasal verb with two particles. Find out, fill out. You can see with those examples why you might think it was a verb plus a preposition, because those particles look like prepositions. But you can test and tell the difference. Let me show you what I mean. Let's look at the difference between these two sentences. Maya looked up the hill. Maya looked up my phone number. Obviously, they mean different things, and they work differently grammatically. And I think this is fascinating, the way you can test to see how they function differently. Let's start with Maya looked up the hill. In that sentence, up the hill is a prepositional phrase expressing where Maya looked. And it functions as a unit because it's a prepositional phrase. You can tell it's a unit because, for example, you could substitute in another adverb there. Maya looked there. Or we could move up the hill around in the sentence. Up the hill is where Maya looked. Where did Maya look? Up the hill. Now let's look at the sentence, Maya looked up my phone number. Here, looked up is a phrasal verb. It's a little unit in and of itself. And we can tell when we start to try to move things around in the sentence. You're going to see that in this case, my phone number works as a unit. It's the direct object, and it doesn't work with up the way up the hill worked. If I were to ask, what did Maya look up, where look up gets to stay together, we would say my phone number. We can move the object my phone number, that noun phrase, around. Maya looked my phone number up. And then we could substitute in it there, Maya looked it up. You couldn't do that with the hill. If Maya was looking up the hill, she wasn't looking it up. But, and with the Maya looked up my phone number, what you can't do is up my phone number is where Maya looked. No, that's because up my phone number is not a prepositional phrase here. Look up is a phrasal verb. My phone number is the object of the phrasal verb look up. So in these cases, you have a phrasal verb with a direct object. And these verbs, these phrasal verbs, will come back when we talk about the well-known rule about whether you can end a sentence with a preposition. And they're going to come back up because sometimes that word at the end of a sentence is not a preposition. Shall we talk about that now? No, we shall not. I will hold off until we talk about prepositions in lecture 17 and 18. Instead, we'll talk in the next lecture about shall and other auxiliary verbs, including why my saying we shall not may have sounded overly formal to you and perhaps even a little stilted.
Lecture 12. Shall we?
Perhaps the best-known usage rule involving auxiliary verbs, which are sometimes known as helping verbs, is the distinction between, or the lack of distinction between, can and may. There is a traditional rule that may is about permission and can is about ability. So, for example, my students can leave class anytime they want to, at least in theory. Given the expectations at the university, however, and the expectations on my syllabus, they may leave when I end class for the day, or they may leave early if they've let me know ahead of time. What they are physically able to do, what they can do, which is get up and leave, and what societal expectations and my syllabus allow them to do, what they may do, are different. And I've sometimes used this example with my students in class, and I'm waiting for the day that then some students just get up and head for the door, even if it's just as a joke. It has yet to happen. With respect to this can versus may distinction, there are also stories circulating out there about elementary school students who ask the teacher, "Can I go to the bathroom?" And the teacher makes them sit there until they get their auxiliary verb straightened out and ask, "May I go to the bathroom?" And I have to say, that just seems mean because, of course, we know exactly what that kid means when they say, "Can I go to the bathroom?" And I say, "Let them go." I thought we'd start this lecture with can and may because they provide a useful example for talking about actual usage of auxiliary verbs and the history of actual usage versus attitudes about what is right and what is wrong in terms of how we use these auxiliary verbs. Historically, the auxiliary verb can has been used to express permission for about 200 years. So these two auxiliary verbs, can and may, have overlapped in the realm of permission for quite a while. We don't tend to use may to talk about ability. We only use can for that. Then there are times when all of us want to use can to refer to permission, specifically in a contracted negative construction, especially a question. Let me show you what I mean about how we prefer can't in those constructions as opposed to mayn't when we're talking about permission. Let's imagine that your friends were all invited to the opening party for a new hip bowling alley, because those things happen. And you ask your friends, can I come? Which seems like a very colloquial question compared with, mayn't I come? Or, may I not come? To give you another example, let's imagine, not that this would ever happen, that I'm negotiating with the lifeguard who's trying to kick me out of the pool in order to put in that cleaning machine, and I say, can I swim just a couple more laps? It sounds much more colloquial, again, than, mayn't I swim just a couple more laps? For some speakers, the can versus may distinction is really a formality distinction about permission. Let's imagine, again, that you're at a play, and there are those formal instructions over the loudspeaker, and the instructions are, audience members may take photos during the performance. Audience members may take photos. You're allowed. But I'm at the play, and I wasn't paying attention. And I turn to the usher and I say, so are photos allowed? And the usher says, yeah, you can take photos. There we're seeing that formality distinction around permission. But here's an important thing to know. And here I feel like I should have this. This is a usage warning, usage warning. A reasonable percentage of the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel rejects can used for permission. Specifically, the panel was asked to think about the question, can I take another week to submit the application? Can I take another week to submit the application? It's a pretty colloquial question. And yet, 37% of the panel still rejected that in 2009. That's when I said a reasonable percentage, 37%. That's still 1 in 3 people on the usage panel rejecting that. It is falling, but clearly there's the percentage of people who don't approve. But there's clearly still some resistance. I have to say it's not something I'm especially attuned to, this difference between can and may, and it is very common in speech, but it is something to watch for in formal writing. As a side note here, both can and may can express possibility for the future. I could say, it may get crazy in here, which is about possibility, or I can say, it can snow in Michigan in May, which is true, and I find it really annoying. The usage issue that I've been talking about here in the first part of this lecture is not about possibility, though, as I was talking about with those two sentences right there, but about permission versus ability. Can and may are two of 9 modal auxiliary verbs, sometimes just called modals, in English. They are can, could, may, might, must, shall, should, will, would. Or at least, we say there are 9, traditionally there are 9. As we'll talk about later in the lecture, we could add a couple more. Now, modal auxiliaries express ability, necessity, obligation, or permission. The ones that do that, we say express deontic modality, or are deontic modals. And then some of them assess the reality of something or the likelihood of something. And we call those epistemic modals that express epistemic modality. you can see the difference between deontic modality and epistemic modality in the two meanings of the auxiliary verb must. Deontic must is about obligation or necessity. I must finish this essay. I must. This is about obligation. And then there's epistemic must, which is an evaluation of reality. This would happen in a sentence like, let's imagine I walk out of my house and I see frost on the grass and I say, it must have fallen below freezing last night. It must have. That must be the reality. In addition to the 9 modal auxiliaries, there are 3 other auxiliary verbs that are called primary auxiliaries. Now, these are not modals, and they include be, have, and do. All the auxiliaries, the primaries and the modals, appear before the main verb, and they require a main verb. The times that they appear at the end of a sentence without a main verb, it's because the main verb has been elided. It's been omitted. Let me show you what I mean. If I were to ask, will you go? And you said, I will. There's an understood main verb there. I will go. If someone asks, can we do that? Yes, we can. Again, the main verb has just been elided. Yes, we can do that. Let's proceed by first talking about modals, and then we'll talk about the other auxiliaries, and finally the intricate ways in which they interact with each other. This is another example of how much grammar you know without having to think about it. Modals work differently from other verbs in that they do not inflect. What that means is that there is no third-person singular present tense s on modals. We wouldn't say, she might. And there's no past tense ed. They musted. There's also no ing. We wouldn't say coulding. And there's no past participle. We wouldn't say he has shalled or he has shallen. Historically, in Germanic, might, could, should, and would were the past tense forms of may, can, shall, and will. But then all of them became modals. So it's no longer the case that they are present and past tense, except sometimes for can. Let me give you an example. Think about if I said, now you can't see the lake from here, but when I was a kid, you could. There we still see a present past tense distinction. Modals, unlike the regular verbs, also have no infinitive form. We don't say to must or to shall. The main verb that appears after the auxiliary verb appears in its base form or its infinitive form. So we say can go and not can goes or can going or can gone. We can see the effect of inserting a modal on our understanding of whether something is possible or likely or allowed in the following sentences. Let's start with the base sentence, I play ping pong. Now we start adding some modals. I can play ping pong. I would probably say this if someone asked me, for example, do I know how to play ping pong? And I say, yeah, I can play ping pong. Or if they want to know whether I will play ping pong with them tonight, and I say, yeah, I can play ping pong tonight. I could add a different modal. I might play ping pong. This is about possibility in the future. I might play ping pong tonight. I might not. A different modal. I would play ping pong. This is clearly about possibility. Perhaps I will play ping pong if something else happens. If that happens, I would play ping pong. I must play ping pong. There are 2 possible interpretations here. One is about obligation, that I must play ping pong. Who knows what reason there is that I must play ping pong, but I must for my own mental health. Or let's imagine, and this would be the epistemic must, that you found some photos of me playing ping pong. And then I say, well then clearly I must play ping pong. That must be the reality. The auxiliary modal will also has 2 meanings. The most common of which is future tense. But will can also express epistemic modality of something we think is likely to happen or we want to have happen. Think about the two different interpretations of this sentence. I'm back to ping pong. I will play ping pong. Here it is just a simple statement of future action. I will play ping pong at some moment in the future. And then, and here I'm going to do it with slightly different intonation, I will play ping pong. This is to express my determination to learn this sport. In standard varieties of English, you get only one modal per verb phrase. But in some varieties of Southern American English, you can get what are called double modals or multiple modals. If you are someone who can say might could, you know exactly what these are. These double modals are, as I said, used most frequently in the South, and they include things like might could, might should, may can, used to could. These double modals often occur in face-to-face interactions as a kind of politeness. For many speakers, they will reduce the face threat. And I talk about face threats as a speech act where we're worried that this might insult someone, we're worried that it's not what they want to hear, and we're trying to be polite here. If you're a speaker who can use double modals, you can say something like, I might should send a contribution, or I might could help contribute to that. So, it's not that it's not possible to put two modals next to each other, quote unquote, in English. It doesn't typically occur in standard English, but it occurs in other varieties. Okay, that's modal auxiliaries, and they do a lot of work in the language. But the three primary auxiliaries do even more heavy lifting in the language, given that two of them, be and have, express aspect and voice for verbs. And auxiliary do has gotten all wrapped up in how we ask questions and how we express negation. The three primary auxiliaries do inflect within the verb phrase. For example, and here we'll use to be, I am talking. Or with have, she has listened. He does exercise. There you see do inflecting. In talking about these three auxiliaries, let's start with be and have and talk about aspect. This will be some review from the previous lecture, and then we'll talk about do. As a review, we have the progressive aspect in English, and this takes the auxiliary verb be in a sentence like, I am playing ping pong, or I was playing ping pong. The perfect aspect uses the auxiliary verb have. I have played ping pong. I had played ping pong. As I mentioned in lecture 10, in African American English, habitual aspect is expressed with invariant be, as in she be jogging early in the morning. Auxiliary be also plays a role in creating passive voice. Passive voice in English takes be plus the past participle. An example would be the ping pong paddle was stolen. So now it's hard for me to play ping pong. Sometimes students confuse passive and progressive, I think probably because both of them take be as an auxiliary verb. And in an attempt to avoid the passive, given that they've been told to do that, they sometimes remove the progressives as well. We'll return to the passive in much more detail in the next lecture. Then there is auxiliary do, which has dramatically increased its functions in English grammar since the Renaissance. Do as an auxiliary has long been used in declarative sentences. He does exercise. And at this point, it typically expresses emphasis. Let me give you an example. I do care about the fate of porcupines. I do. Very emphatic about those porcupines. Since the Renaissance, do has also become a key part and now a standard part of how we make negative statements and questions. Let me show you what I mean. Consider how we make negative statements. A basic negative statement adds not. If we take the sentence, I like dark chocolate, and we make it negative, we get, I do not like dark chocolate. But you'll notice that when I made that negative, I didn't just add not. I also added a form of do. I do not like dark chocolate. That do, its only function is to hold the not. That's what it does, is it just is there so the not can come right after it and often contract with it. In the Renaissance and earlier in English, you could just add the not. I like not dark chocolate. Not that they were talking about dark chocolate in the Renaissance necessarily, but you get my point. Or I could quote Iago from Othello, I like not that. Or from Shakespeare's Richard III, he sends you not to murder me for this. We call this phenomenon where do is starts to be inserted for negatives, the rise of periphrastic do. Periphrastic do is also sometimes called dummy do, which I think is a great expression, and it's called dummy do because it is a dummy form. The do does not carry any meaning. It is just performing a grammatical function to hold the negative particle not. This example of the rise of dummy do does, I think, help show that English, when it's changing, is not always streamlining. I know there are people who like to think that over time English is streamlining, but what we've done with negation has made it much more complicated. Now, we don't need dummy do all of the time. We don't need the auxiliary do if there's another auxiliary verb there, be that a modal or a primary auxiliary. Let me give you an example sentence. Ashley was playing video games earlier. There, because we have the auxiliary verb was, we can put the not in right after that. Ashley was not playing video games earlier. Here's another sentence with an auxiliary. My sister can always make me laugh. Again, we can just put the not after the auxiliary can. My sister can't always make me laugh. We also don't need dummy do if the main verb of the sentence is to be. And I have to say that when you study English, you learn that to be is often an exception if you have a rule. Here's an example sentence. Video games are a good distraction. And now we want to make that negative. We can actually just put the not after the main verb are. Video games are not a good distraction. Auxiliary do, that same periphrastic or dummy do, is also now a key part of how we make yes-no questions. These are questions that just require yes or no as an answer. In the Renaissance and earlier in English, you could simply flip the main verb and the subject to make a question. It was a very straightforward way to make a question. For example, know you the address? Let me give you an actual example from the history of English. Here's one from Romeo and Juliet. How camest thou hither? Now, if there is now in modern English no other auxiliary verb present, and the main verb is anything other than to be, we need to insert do. And then we move that auxiliary do up to the front. How did you come hither? Do you know the address? So we can't say, know you the address. We put in the do, we bump it up to the front in front of the subject. Do you know the address? Now again, as was true with negation, if there's another auxiliary verb there, you don't need to add do. We could say, was Ashley playing video games earlier? Where we take the auxiliary verb was, switch it with the subject, and we get, was Ashley playing? Or, can your sister always make you laugh? We started with your sister can, we flip the subject noun phrase and the auxiliary, can your sister always make you laugh? And if the main verb is to be, we can also still just reverse the verb and the subject. Are video games a good distraction? I want to take a quick moment here to distinguish auxiliary be, have, and do from the main verbs be, have, and do, just to make sure that that's clarified. It would be the difference between I am going, where the am is the auxiliary verb and go is the main verb, versus I am nice, where am is the main verb. Or she has read the book, where has is the auxiliary verb, read is the main verb, compared with she has lots of books, where have is the main verb. An example with do, he does lift weights, where do is an auxiliary, versus He does chores around the house, where do is the main verb. You can, just for fun, combine the auxiliary and main verb of each together. For example, I am being nice. I am, auxiliary be, being, main verb be, nice.